Welcome to Board Game Binge, the place where we bring you bite-sized, bingeable board game content across the industry. I'm your host, James Staley, and in this episode, we're chatting with Malachi Ray Rempin, owner of Keen Bean Studio, and the illustrator of Power Vacuum, the treasonous, trick-taking card game that's currently on Kickstarter. Mal, welcome to the binge. How are you doing, sir?
Very well, thank you, James. Happy to be here.
Oh, I'm happy to have you, man. So I was reading your bio, and you've got this kind of cross-planetary jet-setting situation going on. So you start off in did I read somewhere like Mexico, but now you're in Germany? Like, can you walk me through this whole path?
Well, I was born in Switzerland, and then that's where the fellowship begins. And then my parents moved to the States. We moved to New Mexico, but it was called New Mexico before Mexico was named. So it's actually the old Mexico.
In
the USA. I lived there until I graduated college. And then I met a girl in Europe and I moved to Europe to follow her with her consent. And then we bounced around. We were in France for a while. Then we were in Italy. We were in Morocco. And now we are in Germany. We lived in Berlin for 11 years. And we just moved down here to Ravensburg. Might sound familiar to some board game aficionados.
Yeah.
Home of the Ravensburger. They're just down the street. And we moved here last summer. So now we've been here. And it's great.
And you've been like an illustrator for, I guess, most of your life, have you?
I mean, I guess it depends how you define illustrator. I've never been like classically trained. My background is in film. I studied film and I made films for many years. And then I taught film for many years. And only recently, since doing the board game thing full time, I'm sort of not in film anymore. But I always kind of did drawing as a hobby. I did cartooning, really, like comics and cartoons. And yeah. I always liked the comics page of the newspaper. And I always did my own little comics, usually in like the margins of my math test at school or whatever. And then when I moved to France, so when I moved to Europe for the first time, I wanted to chronicle how it was living in a foreign country for the first time for me. And I didn't want to write emails or write a blog or anything like that. And so I thought I would do a comic. I thought every week I'll do a comic about like something about my experience so I can send it to friends and family. And I just never stopped. And that was this web comic called Itchy Feet, which I've been doing. It's a travel and language comic, which I've been doing now for 13 years. And every week, every Sunday. And that just kind of, with that, I stuck. The drawing thing stuck. I've been and kind of illustrating and doodling and drawing since then. But yeah, I've never really like trained it, all self-taught basically.
Yeah. And then Itchy Feet, is this only on like, is it a digital format or is it ever going to like print or?
Yeah, I have books on my site. You can get Itchy Feet collections. They're print on demand from Amazon. So it's nothing fancy, but I think I'll probably do a Kickstarter for like a big hardbound collection at some point.
Sort of the best of something.
Sorry,
like a coffee table book almost with the comic or
exactly, yeah, something like that. I mean, yeah, so I have paperback collections that I put together, I designed and put together, but those are physical, but yes, it's released through an app called Tiny View, which is like sort of comics page for the web place where you can get a lot of different web comics. So they've been hosting Itchy Feet digitally the last couple of years. Yeah.
And then why the move from film into gaming? Like, that seems like maybe they're not as far away as people think they are from each other, but I mean, I guess they're both kind of, you know, you're taking your creative skill and applying it to it, but what made you kind of leave the film side?
Yeah. So I had this comic Itchy Feet. In 2017, the audience was big enough that I was looking at merchandising, and I had never been all that big into board games. I had played little board games, but I always kind of played video games more than board games. And then around that same time, I was like, as I was looking for merchandising opportunity, a friend of mine in Berlin started getting me into board games. My first modern board game, I still to this day, point of pride, I've never played Catan, which is everybody's like gateway into this industry, right? I still haven't played it. I have played Carcassonne, but my gateway game was Pandemic Legacy. So it was like a modern board game. It was a legacy game, kind of the legacy game, and it was a cooperative game. Like I had never really, like on all three of those levels, my mind was blown. And we played through the whole campaign and we absolutely loved it. And so that was my like initial break into board games as a hobby. And then one of these friends that was part of this game group from this Pandemic Legacy group was like, you should do a card game. It was also around the same time. It was a little bit after Exploding Kittens came out. And this was kind of, that's based on this webcomic, The Oatmeal, or like from the same guy anyway. And I didn't think I was going to do oatmeal business, but I thought like, oh, I could do a similar thing. It'd be kind of fun to make like a party game, like a card game that then used my comic and my art. And then, so I put this together with one of my fans. I reached out and asked, because I'd never designed a game before. And so I reached out to my fan base from the comic and said, hey, does anyone have any game experience that they want to help me design this game? And one of this guy, another Canadian actually, Maxime, reached out and we worked on it for about a year. And then I put it out on Kickstarter, fully expecting to make like 10 grand if I was lucky. And I thought like, that'd be great. Then I can make this game. We can print 1,000 copies and that'll be that. I'll go back to my movie making. And that campaign, this was in 2017, raised $113,000. And I was like, wait, what? That's crazy. And so we printed it, we did it, and then that was it. I didn't have anything else. I wasn't like planning to get into this as like a business at all. But like that's way more money than I had ever seen than like any of my film work raise for sure. Yeah. In fact, the only reason I hadn't ever gone to Kickstarter with my film work is because I didn't have an audience. I didn't have a following from my film work. I had a following from the comic. So it was like obvious to me. Like at the time, I think I had probably 50,000 followers across all of social media. Not even that many. And I thought like, okay, not that many for a comic anyway. Comics can get up into the millions and sure. Followers. Especially this was before Facebook had also kind of tweaked their algorithms to sort of disincentivize creators from spreading work. They wanted to incentivize creators to pay to actually reach their own followers. Yeah. Anyway, whatever. This was just before that. So I was quite lucky that it kind of built up organically as back when organic followings was the thing. And where was I going with this? Right. So
you went from your itchy feet, the travel game, I guess, was that first one, right?
Yes. So that was the game. I didn't have anything else lined up. I went back to my film work. And then my wife was like, that was great. Like, you should do another game. That was awesome. And so I thought, well, okay, what else can I make a game about? I don't know anything about most things in life except film.
Movies.
So I thought, I was looking around and I was like, huh, there hasn't really been like a filmmaking game. There have been film games that are themed around the film industry, but I could tell immediately that they were by people who, like Reiner Knizia made one way back when. And there were some other ones floating around, but I could tell they were all made by people who were on the outside of the industry looking in. It was like a theme that they were putting on top of, they were draping over a design. And I was like, no, I want to make a film making game, like where it's about the making of like the shooting of a movie, which is something that I know very well. Yeah. And not many other people do. That's kind of, it's one thing anyway, that I could bring to tabletop that I hadn't seen before. So that's where Roll Camera came from.
And I saw that everywhere. I mean, this is when I saw that you were the creator of the document, like, oh my God, they did Roll Camera. I saw that literally everywhere. Right when you guys were doing the campaigns, and then I think you did like a reprint as well, right?
Did a reprint and expansion. Yeah. So yeah, that one was even bigger. And I guess I got lucky with that one that there hadn't really been another movie game. The cooperative games were kind of in vogue at the time, or like there were people looking for a lot of the pandemic model of cooperative games had been copied a lot. So there were a lot of like pandemic-ish co-op games and Roll Camera was not like that. It didn't really follow the same structure. And so I think it felt refreshing to people. And anyway, whatever the reason were, that was also a really, really, for me anyway, a pretty big hit, a pretty smashing success. And so I was like, okay, I guess I'll do an expansion. And I timed it so that the expansion would release, because I saw when the campaign launched and then Rado named it, or like, this is before he named it his game of the year, but it was, I could tell he was really excited about it. And I thought, okay, there's buzz. And so I thought, I'll design an expansion as the campaign is printing and delivering. And then the campaign for the reprint and expansion will launch when the game hits. And that timed perfectly at like, bam, it landed. The buzz was at its peak, and that reprint campaign did even better. And that was like 3 years ago. And so I did not plan it very well. I think if I knew that this was going to, like, this was a thing I was going to want to keep doing, Power Vacuum would have come out a lot earlier. It would have come out, obviously, when, you know, one of the things you want to try to do as a publisher is to, if you can, you get this cadence where you sort of launch. When you land, the next thing is launching, and then when that lands, the next thing is launching. You try to ride these waves, and
which isn't easy to do. I mean, it's to, you know, constantly have games coming out even on like an annualized schedule. You have to have things in the hopper like 3 years in advance, right? So you have the development cycle of the game, you have the creating of the game, then the developing of it to, you know, get all the, you know, the art and the manufacturing, everything lined up before you even get to Kickstarter. And so you always have, as a publisher, to constantly have games coming out, you have to have something going in each of those different time frames at all times, right? In order for things to kind of line up, right?
Totally. And I didn't have that, but it was a big enough success. And at the same time, that was a big enough hit. And I felt like, okay, I think I can do something with this. I can make a go at this as a publisher. And around the same time, I was burning out at my job, which was, I was running a film school. So over the years since I did the Itchy Feet game, I was basically moving up the ranks of this film school from like day tutor to like course lead to like program lead to then I was basically managing the whole film school, and I couldn't handle it. It was just too much stress, and it was a great place. I really loved teaching, and that's one thing I do miss right now about my old job. And I love the collaborative atmosphere. This is my whole office at the moment, so there's just me and then people who I collaborate with, you know, over Zoom like this. So but I had to, like, going back to exactly what you said at the very beginning, which is, it is a creative outlet. Like, I get to, at least for the foreseeable future, design, illustrate, and put out products that I have complete control over their sort of creative direction and the marketing of it, the presentation of it. And I have control of it all the way into the marketplace and into the hands of people who I can reach directly and who are now numbering enough that I can release something and be at least have a good feeling that it will fund, if not that it will. Power Vacuum's doing much better than I was thinking it would. So it's a creative outlet. And I thought, like, well, heck, like, I never had that with film. As much as I love film, and cinema is always going to be my first true love, I just never had that exposure. I never had that audience. I never had that market. Never.
It's a little more predictable too, right? Like, I mean, you can never predict exactly where you're going to land on your Kickstarter campaign, but going in, if you do all the kind of, you know, set the page right, set your, you know, pre-build of your audience, if you go through kind of checking off the main boxes of what you need to do to put together a well-rounded campaign, I mean, you usually know you're going to fund. It's just a matter of, how far over the funding goal are we going to go, right? And that becomes kind of the question. But it's become very scientific. And I mean, we talked to Launch Boom on this last week or 2 weeks ago. It becomes almost formulaic, right? As to, okay, here's the product and here's the audience. And, you know, here's all the tools I'm using to kind of put it out there. Based on that, the math says I should be in around kind of this range here, right? And for the most part, you're probably going to land somewhere in that range, right?
Yeah, totally. And that is exactly part of the appeal not just from a business perspective for me, but from a creative perspective, because you can be you can put your work out there at a relatively early stage and with relatively low overhead costs. And I say relative to the film industry is maybe a unfair example, but like the overhead cost of putting something into the world in the film industry is in the tens of millions at the lowest. right? Of dollars. Like the amount of manpower and dollars and investment and trust and it required to put, and like just pure sweat and blood required to put a film together is outrageous compared to a board game, which basically can be paper and ink until its final moments when, you know, you put the design, the graphics and art into it, and then it's kind of ready to go, which to me just felt like paradise. Like working on a board game is the easiest thing in the world for me coming off of like coming out of the film industry for that
reason. Well, can imagine like in the film industry, if you could get people to decide whether they like your film before you have to go and expend all the cost.
This is
essentially what you're doing with Kickstarter, right? Is you're putting it out there. I mean, there's costs obviously in development and so forth, but you know, before you go and actually make the thing, you can find out if people want the thing, right?
You can find out if the thing is fun. Like that alone, a script is such a terrible blueprint for a movie. It's unbelievable to me that it is still used like routinely as the people decide whether or not they're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars based on a script, which doesn't even have pictures in it. Like it's crazy to me. Yeah. Whereas a board game, like, so, you know, the designer Cole Worley of like Root and Oath and Pax Pamir, he had this thing about like, when you're designing a board game, you basically want, there's this thing called the iterative loop, right? Which is like you iterate, you create, you put it out, you test it, you get feedback, and then you iterate again. And that cycle, the way he puts it is you want that as tight as you can get it, where like you want it to where you're iterating, getting feedback in as quickly and efficiently as you can, because that is the creative process, and or at least that is the development process in board games. With film, I thought about this, and I think film might be the medium with the longest iterative loop, because you are never 100% sure how a film's going to land until it's in the cinema in front of an audience, which is like many years after you've started, maybe decades after you've come up with the idea, and many, many, many tens of millions of, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in the hole. And like, nobody's 100% sure, like, is it even good? We don't know. Like maybe it'll come together in the edit. Like that's madness. It's madness.
That's crazy. When you were reaching out to your audience that on that first game and said, hey, I want to create a game around Itchy Feet. Did you have a lot of people at that point reach back to you? Or like, did you have kind of your pick of the litter, or did you just kind of get lucky and you got the one guy that had the idea?
That one, basically, I got lucky. Maxime came to me. He was and still is a mobile game designer. So he had experience in game design, and he brought a lot of these tools and development concepts to the table. But they're not ones that I've seen used all that often in board game design, which is interesting since then, like learning much more about board game development and design and publishing. I haven't seen some of the stuff he used when we were working on it. And so it was, but I didn't know any better. And he had far more experience with me than in any kind of game. It was the first game I ever designed. So I got lucky.
That's crazy. And then, so with Power Vacuum, so where did the idea for this come from? And I'm going to try to get the screen up here and share this while we're chatting. Where did you get the idea for Power Vacuum? Where'd this come from?
So I have a lesson with many designers. Like I have a long list of ideas, a long list of concepts. And one of them was Power Vacuum, and it happened. I had seen the film, The Death of Stalin, by Armando Iannucci, who's the guy who did Veep. He made this film with Steve Buscemi and what's his name? Jason Isaacs. Which is a like really dark comedy set in the weeks after Stalin's death, exactly as it sounds like, as these ministers in his government try to basically jostle each other to be the next one in power. And that same week, I saw the film The Dark Crystal, like the 80s film. And it just struck me, like seeing these two films back to back, I was like, these movies have the same story. Like the I don't know if you remember The Dark Crystal, but the like evil Skeksis, which are like in this horrible castle, their emperor dies. And then their whole story, like their part of the story, is all about like these ministers in this emperor's like inner circle, like jostling each other to be the one to take the power. And I was like, this is the same story. And what's great about both of these stories is that in both cases, they're making partnerships and deals with each other. Like the people that are, they're not, it's not that they're all, it's everyone from themselves. It's like, oh, they're talking in a room together. And then that one will go and talk to this one in a room. And then those two will talk to each other in a room. And everybody knows that everyone's doing this. It's not a secret. Like, there's no hidden information. Everybody, other than like what they're talking about specifically, but everybody is fully aware that everyone's out for themselves. But at the same time, everyone cannot succeed entirely by themselves. They need to use each other, and they all know that they need to use each other, and they all know that they're being used and using. It's great. It's like, let's say, like fluid partnerships and dynamics. And I thought, like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to have a board game that captured that feeling where, like, you were never 100% sure who was really on your team and who wasn't on your team, or those could change at the drop of a hat. Because in most board games, there are especially card games, like, there are team games.
Yeah.
But it's, you decide at the beginning, like, if you're playing like spades on teams, or you're playing bridge or something, like, you have your partner and they're your partner. You're the good guys and the other people are the bad guys, and that's it. It's very binary. Or in a hidden role, like social deduction game, it's like unsure, it's unclear. Like, are they on your team? Are they not on your team? Are they one of the bad guys? Are they not one of the bad guys? Are they like one of these gray area roles? But it's all about like sussing out which of the roles are they. I didn't want either of those things. I wanted something where you were sure that people were against you, but that you still needed to work together sometimes. And I had no idea how to accomplish this, but I knew that the name needed to be Power Vacuum. And I knew if the name was going to be Power Vacuum, then the world had to be with anthropomorphic household appliances.
Oh, it's awesome. Like, the artwork is awesome.
I was like, so that came first. This like the title and this sort of image was the first thing that came up. And then I tried to design the game, and I tried a bunch of versions. I did a lot of research into trick taking. I had this idea that maybe trick taking could be the good central mechanism for it to kind of glue the game. And then there would be something around the trick taking that would be about, that would capture this theme rather than the actual mechanism itself. And I tried a bunch of stuff and threw a bunch of stuff against the wall, as you do as a designer, and nothing stuck, and everything kind of, so I put it on the shelf. And then one day, one of the guys that I had been designing or had been testing this game with, who himself is a sort of aspiring game designer, Caleb Wenzel Fischer, a friend of mine from Berlin. We knew each other from the film world. We were actually teaching at this film school together. And he also was really into board games by coincidence. And he came to me one day because he loved this concept. He loved the title and the world and the idea, the sort of conceit of it, and the premise. And one day he came to me and he was like, Mel, I've got Power Vacuum. I think I've got it. And this was last summer. So it was relatively, like, I played it and I was like, oh, this is it. This is Power Vacuum. You're right. You were right. You got it. And and then we obviously iterated on it a lot and like developed it and worked on it. But like the core idea was pretty much the same as what we're publishing. So it was pretty impressive how quickly it like snapped together. And I keep telling them, like, don't expect that every project is going to fall together this quickly. I mean, it was a matter of weeks before I was already doing art we were so confident that the game was pretty much there. We did end up changing a lot in the months since then, but the core, again, like I said, the core was basically there. So it was a really quick turnaround for a game.
It is, for those who are joining us, either TikTok, Instagram, or catching us on the replay, the artwork is awesome. And, you know, how the different characters' heads are like, one guy's a toaster, another person iron, another person a blender. The minister's, yeah. I think, is hilarious. Can you walk us through, and I'm showing on screen here, this kind of central gizmo you have where people are, it looks like there's plugs that are connecting like one minister to another, because this seems pretty unique for a trick-taking game, and it kind of honed in on it right away. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, so that's kind of the thing that makes Power Vacuum unique, is this control board and the agenda cards. So basically, it's pretty standard must follow trick taking for the most part. And then if you win the highest or you have the trump, you win the trick. If you win the trick, you get a point, or you can choose to keep or capture one of the cards that had been played, and you can use that towards your next hand. If you play the lowest card of any suit in the trick, you get to manipulate this control board. And this control board is like a ring, and seated around this ring, it's inspired by the table from the war room table from Dr. Strangelove.
Circular
table, and these ministers are seated around it, and you play as one of the ministers, but these five ministers are always in play no matter what the player count is. And each of those ministers starts with a couple power tokens around next to them. And when you play this lowest card, you get to manipulate. So first, and this the each in front of each minister is a little socket, and then there is a this plug component, which has two plugs and then a cable connecting them. And these plugs sit in one of the sockets each. So it's always connected to two of the ministers, or there's also a sixth spot, which is the power supply itself. So it's always connected to something. First thing you do when you play that low card is you can move power between like either one way or the other way along this cable. So you can move power, say, from the green like player to the black player, even though they might not actually be players. They might be dummy players. Mm. Or you can take it one way or the other. You choose the direction. And then you move one of the plugs. So first you move the power, and then you can move one of the plugs. And the reason you want to do this is every player at the setup at this the start of the round has, in addition to the card, like the trick cards that you play, the regular playing cards, you have an agenda card. And the agenda card is like a double-sided card that has one, that has two of the appliances on it. And there are 10 of these cards in every combination of these appliances. And you reveal your agenda at some point during the round, and you will gain points. Like you decide the orientation that this card is going to go facing either. Let's say you have an agenda card with green on one side and black on the other side. So you may want black to have the most power and green to have the least power, or the other way around, green to have the most, black to have the least, up to you when you reveal. And then it's public and it's stuck that way. But if you're right about that at the end of the round, you gain points for each side that's correct. So if you had black for most power, green for least power, if the plugs are plugged into green and black, you would move black to green, right? Easy enough, or the other way around, depending on whichever way you put the agenda card. But the plugs aren't always on black to green. That's the first complication. So you need to move power, but you can move by like taking power away from other players. You can then, by doing that, be giving power to like gaining the other player, the other appliances can be gaining power because you're taking it away from one and giving it to another. And the other players also have agenda cards, potentially with one of those appliances on it as well. And they may want the same thing you want. They may also want black to have the least power. So you're like allied on that front, but they may want a different appliance to be have the most power. And that appliance might be you, or you might have yourself on the agenda card. So there are all of these layers to like the way that these agenda cards and the player dynamics kind of emerge out of every round. And the trick taking, you're trying to win the tricks to gain power, but you're trying to lose the tricks to manipulate the power. So this is the core tension at play, basically. And the thing that causes this emergent feeling of like, okay, we're together on this, right? We agree on this. Sure. But we are definitely don't agree on that. No. I'm against you on that. So this is the core of Power Vacuum.
And then the statues, how do the statues come into play?
The statues. So at the end of the round, you gain points. You gain points if your agenda is correct. So for each side of your agenda that's correct, you gain points based on the timing of when you reveal. So basically, the earlier in the round you reveal, the more they're worth, but the longer the other players have to thwart your agenda because they can see what it is. Mm. So the longer you wait, the less valuable that becomes, essentially. You gain points from that, and then you gain points potentially from tricks, and then you also gain points from the power that is in front of your character at the end of the round. So that's another thing. You want your character to gain power, but if your character's not in your agenda, you don't want them to gain too much power. You want to keep yourself like just under the height, you know, the most. And the way you track points is for every 10 points that you gain, you can take one of these statue pieces. There are four types. There's a foundation, a legs, a torso, and a head. And the first player to complete the full statue, basically to 40 points, wins. So the statues are entirely a scorekeeping mechanism, but which is so gratuitous, but it's so much fun. It's so silly and fun to like build these stupid little statues. And with the upgrade kit that we have, they're actually 3D meeples that you can stack, and they're like, you create this like wacky statue. So that's what the idea of the statue. We wanted something with the scoring that was different. We wanted something special and just not a points track, you know, like, God, come on, there's got to be something we can do that really feels like thematic. And this was the thing that Caleb hit on, which I just thought was absolutely genius.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, yeah, I can see the meeples here. Oh, that's wicked. Yeah, same just before we went on air, I got a buddy that just absolutely loves trick taking games. And he's already backed this game, of course. This has to be added to his collection.
That's great.
So I'll get a chance to play this one this ships because he'll bring it to game night for sure.
Awesome.
I'd be remiss if I don't mention that you guys have blown your goal out of the water. I'm going to put this in Canadian dollars because, quite frankly, it's the only way I can see it. But you're at almost 78,000 on a goal of just under 16,000 Canadian dollars, 1,162 backers. Still got 16 days to go. So that back-end hockey stick is obviously going to place us much, much higher, probably north of 100,000 for sure. And I can see why. I mean, the artwork on this game, it just looks phenomenal. I like this whole mechanism in the center. It's kind of novel. It's cool, especially for a trick-taking game, right? Because people that play trick-taking games are always looking for something different, right? Because you have kind of core elements of the same, but kind of what's the hook of the game. And I like this kind of power shuffle back and forth. It's cool. Obviously now you mentioned that, you know, Keen Bean Studio is your kind of, you're in it to win it now, right? This is now your full-time gig. Do you have other games that you're working on that you could talk about or tease, or kind of what comes after this?
Definitely. One of the games I started working on after Roll Camera, the expansion ended, and I was fully intending that it would come out, you know, when the expansion landed. So it would hit that cadence we were talking about. It would hit that wave, but it ended up being way harder to design than I thought. And I always, so the game is called Almighty, and it is a big game. It is a big, heavy strategic game. And initially it was like kind of an area control game, but then I realized that wasn't going to work. So now it's more of a Euro game. Yeah. And I've never designed a heavy or like a medium, it's midweight heavy. I'd say it's on par with like Terraforming Mars in terms of complexity. Wow. Okay. So significantly heavier than, Roll Camera, or certainly Power Vacuum, which is a card game essentially, with like a card game plus. And it's just been taking so long to get right. But you know, a Euro has to be really tight. It has to be really, balance is the wrong word, but it has to be deep and interesting, and it has all these features of the genre and that are requirements of it that things that you can get away with in a co-op game, like the rules are loose. In a co-op game, it's like, well, if it's unfair or if the rules don't really like make 100% sense or they aren't completely airtight, nah, who cares? It's a co-op. You can kind of figure it out together. Not the case in a like competitive strategy game. It has to be airtight. So it's taken me a lot longer to pull this together. And I brought on a co-designer. His name's Kevin Privale from my following. Again, I'm pulling back to this old partnership thing. And that is a game that it should be coming out next year, hopefully. And I'm really, really grateful that Power Vacuum came to me in the meantime, because while Almighty is still baking in the oven, Power Vacuum can kind of come out to sort of keep eyes and interest on Keen Bean Studio until it does come out. Almighty, the concept of it is you are building a pantheon of ancient gods. And then those, you build a following as well of like little mortals, and you act on them, you curse them, and you bless them with miracles, and you like confuse them with mysterious omens, and you make outrageous demands of them, and so on. To like, there's all kinds of reasons why you're doing this. One of the reasons is to gain souls. If you kill them, you get their souls, and they're in your underworld, and those count for various things. So it's essentially like a resource management tableau building kind of Euro set in the world of ancient gods with a sort of sense of humor. Cause I feel like there aren't enough funny Euros. They're all too serious. So I'm going to capture the mark. I'm going to corner the market on funny Euro games.
I think you might. Well, for those who do want to check out Power Vacuum, I'm going to put a link in the show notes so it's easy to find it. Of course, you go to Kickstarter, just type in Power Vacuum. You'll easily find it there as well. Check out the campaign. It's worth taking a look at. It looks like a lot of fun, and people like this this art style are certainly going to hone in on this very, very quickly. Mal, I want to wish you all the best of this campaign and the next endeavor you have coming.
Thank you, James. This was fun. Thank you.
All right, my friend. You take care. Cheers.
This has been an episode of the Board Game Binge Podcast, hosted by James Staley, produced by James Staley and Mike Bruner, with original music by Nick Smith. If you'd like to watch these interviews live, simply subscribe to our YouTube channel, Board Game Binge, and you'll get access to live interviews, giveaways, and interesting board game content from a
across the industry. I can't wait for you to join us. See you next time.